Lechora, there's both a chiyuv and a mitzvah to masvid a chacham. The steps of chacham shemes are called softim alav. The Gemara tells that it comes atel the hesbedish al chacham, terrible things. At the same time, we know that the Gemara tells the Sanhedrin that a hesped is really yikra d'shchivi, it's really for kavod ames. And anybody who knew or literally knows that he wasn't interested in kavod, he didn't explicitly ask not to have a hesbedim. But those who remember his 70th birthday, he only agreed al tanai that the yeshiva split shas and everybody learned shas in honor of the occasion. You should have a birthday party. It should be token. There should be substance. There should be shiurim. He had shiurim. His talmidim gave shiurim. His 80th birthday, his children gave shiurim. It was kulo token. And kavod, it didn't speak to him. So I think that he would ask him to have, divi hitaru, a gathering where people would learn from his ways and would be inspired, hopefully, to try to become better avdei Hashem. So that's what I'm going to try to do. I'll try to be careful not to be mazim at all, despite the fact that it says in Shulchan Aruch, as we know, that by a hesped one is permitted to magzim slightly, but Rav Lichtenstein's midas emes was so, by him the midah was so strong, it would be inappropriate, again, from his perspective, to magzim at all. And the truth is, if you're magzim, I think you take away from the godliness, because the godliness was that he was a person, and he was a great person. The minute you make him into malach, so then we have nothing to learn from him, we have nothing to emulate, and the mela is the point of this gathering is obsolete. When coming to describe a person of such great stature, such great magnitude, the endeavor is futile, because we know that he was so multifaceted, he was so great in so many ways, and from our limited perspective, we can only describe what we saw. I've listened to many Hasidim online, they're all wonderful, and they all were very limited. Not all, but many of them were very, because first of all, people only had 20 minutes to speak, and people weren't able to express themselves. I set the thing to share for 11 o'clock so I'd have more time. But in addition to the time constraints, by definition, people, and myself included, only saw him a certain way in a certain time. I knew him for 20 years, from the time he was about 60 to 80. And by definition, I'm interested in A, so if I like Lomdus, I'll speak about his Lomdus, and if the American rabbi appreciated his Hanhaga, so they spoke of him as a manhig. And if somebody was into philosophy, they emphasized his contribution to that realm. And I think Rav Willick said in his Hesped that just like the Rav was so multifaceted and no one person could be Masvid, I think the same is true here, and that awareness, I think, is important in that I'm trying to present to you one limited perspective, my perspective, and I hope that would add something to the broader description of this Adam Gadol. He, of course, had a very, very profound impact on my life. And the Gemara says in Yevavot, the Tavivavim Beis, that when Rav Elazar said a famous one to the Beis Medrash, and shamed his Rebbe, Rav Yochanan, he didn't quote Rav Yochanan's name. Rav Yochanan was very upset. How can you say my Torah without saying it in my name? And another Talmud, the Gemara tells us, Rav Yaakov Ar-Idi, told Rav Yochanan, he said, tell him like this. Everybody knew it from Moshe. So Rav Yaakov Ar-Idi was Menachem, his Rebbe of Yochanan. The Rav Elazar is not stealing your Torah. He's a Talmud. He's part of you. And Rav Yochanan Hiniach Daito. And I think that my ability to stand here, to express myself, to think, to be the Eved Hashem, all comes from it's a school to be a Talmud. The people here, Miller, Ben Arshu, knew him for much longer, much better. But like I said, everybody has a different perspective, and so I just want to describe various aspects of his personality. I'm going to begin actually with the Shiurim. The first time I met him was in a Shir Klali in Elul of Tavshin Nunhei, Tish Ketushin, and it was an amazing Shir. I thought I wouldn't understand it. I was told, Ilchatkhila, you don't get your hopes up, it's very hard to understand it, and complex. And I sat, I got a good seat. You have to like save the seat in the front. I got a good seat, and I sat there at the edge of my seat the whole time, really tried to listen, and I really understood a lot. More than I understood in subsequent Shiurim, because I listened more. You know, by listening, if you push yourself, you can understand him. And the Shiur was actually unique, because most of the Shiur Pesichos were magnificent in terms of spreading the whole assessment in front of you, mentioning important Yisodos. That Shiur was very nekudati, it was very specific about Yishus, Kodem HaTorah, Acharei HaTorah, the nature of Znus, Zona is a shame, called Shem in the Gafra, you can do Znus, but not be a Zona, the Chule. So that Shiur Pesicha, again, was very nekudati, but it was also fascinating. And I immediately was attracted, and I fell in love with his derech halimud. He also generally the Shiur Pesicha would describe the mechitzasa, the kitzur, and what kitzur means, going sugi by sugi, telling you what the token was. And then he would discuss the rishonim and the sefarshi on the mechitzasa, and it was the first time I heard people speaking about the Rabban and the Rav Yo. And or Zarua and Sefer Trumos, and there was no bull to his. He studied everything, and he took all in all the various perspectives, and then he would organize the sugya. And today, chinuch is very different than it used to be. Somebody wrote an article a few years ago called Edutainment, that today people like half teachers and half they're into trying to. It's entertainment essentially to try to get people in, and he was none of that. He was kulo emes, and he lost something in for that. There are people who needed that. He wasn't so into the milsa to be chusa ideas. I think I remember once or twice in the shira after all the years that he made a joke, and even then I think only somebody who really appreciated him laughed. He expected students to sit and to study and to listen, and if you did, you could, even if you weren't so brilliant, you were able to gain a lot from his derech halimud. He always wanted to see the sources inside and see the primary sources. So if the Ramban is quoted by the Ran, it's much easier to understand the Ran. He would say, look at the Ramban. And if the Rav Yo was quoted by the Mordechai, he would tell you to look at the Mordechai, even though the Mordechai is the back of the Gemara, and the Rav Yo, there's only two copies on the shelf. He wanted people to see things inside, to see the primary sources. And the primary source is really the Torah. He started with the Pesukim, he analyzed the Pesukim, the Lomdus that comes out of the Pesukim, the Rishonim on Chumash, and he really organized the Shiurim in a very, very defined way. Something that's unique. Many people start with, Akasha, and he started from the beginning, and he moved on, and there was a clear Shita in his Derech HaLimud. I once heard him say that people think Yeshiva is a place to learn Torah. And Yeshiva is a place to learn how to learn Torah. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. That's the way he taught. He really was teaching people how to learn, giving people the kelim to be able to learn. After a couple of years, like I said, even a person who wasn't a brilliant student would be able to anticipate what the questions he would raise, what's the hafmin, what's the maskana, what's the difference between the hafmin and the maskana, which hanacha does the maskana reject. What's the makor? How does the makor affect the nature? How does that affect the hekei? So that's the meaning. Everything was very clear. He gave shiurim methodology, but really all the shiurim were methodological in their nature. I think that's part of the reason people don't appreciate his godless from his shiurim. Again, if you're an Amaret, so you see his shiurim, wow, it's amazing. But the truth is that his godless was much greater than his shiurim because he limited himself in his shiurim in order to teach the students. There are many Rosh Hashivos who get up, and it's almost like you're watching a magic show where there's a rabbit in a hat, and there's the last six good questions, and one you sowed, sweep the deck, And it's magnificent. You open up, you know, Shurim Zechari Mari from the Rav. I never sat in the Shurim, but I heard it. It was like you're sitting on edge. It was amazing. He had none of that. He wasn't into magic. He wasn't into impressing the crowd. He wanted to learn with you. And learning with you means rolling up your sleeves, reading the Gemara, asking the important questions, understanding the possibilities, trying to organize the Shittas in the Rishonim. And that's something that if you did enough times, you would be able to replicate. You'd be able to do yourself and then eventually teach others how to do. So, like I said, his written Shiurim, I mean, when they wanted, the Talmidim wanted to put them out, I was in the Yeshiva at the time. He was a little hesitant. He agreed finally when they decided they were going to put it out on the Sechas Taros. Who learns the Sechas Taros? So he said that contribution is the fact that people are learning it. That itself is important. And then in Zvachim. And then the Talmidim, I think, pushed him to publish other Sechas. He initially did not want to have a Basra on things that are, you know, run of the mill. He wanted the contribution to be the fact that people were studying these areas. I actually had the discussion of learning with Chavrusa with Shimoni Gerti, who wrote the first book, they're from his notes, and I saw the inscribed copy that Lichtenstein gave him in Erev Yom Kippur, where he thanks him for the rayon, the bitzua, and a number of other adjectives, why he really pushed it through, and then he concludes the remarks in the Sasha, like I said, dated Erev Yom Kippur, the haikar ala dvekut b'Torah. He appreciated the fact that he was sitting and learning. That was his, Hakaras HaTov, that he was dovek in the learning. It's interesting because after Erev Kippur, for Erev Kippur was like a deadline where he would really, finish up things that were outstanding over the course of the year. I heard many stories about things that Erev Kippur, he would return the money Erev Kippur that he owed somebody, and he would, write, a thank you letter to somebody that he felt he didn't, thank enough. Erev Kippur was a very significant time for Lichtenstein, and he showed the Zechar to Shimoni at that point in terms of the Sefer. But another reason I think the Shiurim aren't they don't really express the godless is that the whole godless was the Masa Masa, the question and answer. People would be given Marim Kolmos to prepare, and if they weren't prepared, they would know they would be asked upon, called upon to read, and it would be embarrassing. And sometimes even when they did prepare, they couldn't read because it was just Mamish was like Yerah Saron with the people who Mamish were who knew the answers couldn't even express it. It was amazing to see. But he the whole godless was that you were learning with him, and you can't write that in a sefer. It's not nitan for Dvarim Shebichtav. So I think there's a lot lost. Again, the fact that people are learning Kodesh the Kami, and there's a whole sefer Mesachos Horios. Who learns Horios? They're saying in Bris they don't learn Horios. There are no yeshivas learn Horios. It's an amazing sefer. I actually once tried to learn Horios. I think it was 3 months before my daughter was born, my first daughter. I said, oh, we should make a siyum. We're going to make a simchas bas. We want to make a suz mitzvah, so we make a siyum. So I figured, I'll learn a daf a week on Shabbos. It's about 12, 13 daf. Make a siyum. So by the time my daughter was born, 3 months later, I did a daf and a half because the sefer is just so rich and so difficult. He gave shira for a whole zman in sefer Horios. That itself is a contribution. Again, the shiurim themselves, I think, are useful. You know, certainly people who left the background, but I don't think they really capture the godless of the shiurim, despite the fact that he won an award for it. In Mitzvah Aaron, the sefer that came out just a few years ago, those are things he actually wrote. I think there you see more of his godless. Again, he wrote 30-page articles. It was hard for people to read them, and it was also part of his godless that he agreed when they edited it to put in summaries. If you look at Mitzvah Aaron, every 10 pages there's a little tamsit for people who can't sit and read 30 pages, which include myself in that category. And he recognized that there are many people who are not like him who can't sit for 30 pages. So let's put summaries to let people appreciate what he's done, so they can't lose the train of thought. And the fact that he's able to change, I think it's also the godless. And the chidushim are unbelievable. The Hakdama is beautiful. Anybody who hasn't seen it should see the Hakar Satov, to this opportunity to learn Torah, to teach Torah. It's really very, very beautiful. Part of what we saw in the Shiurim was the Zamelus. And Zamelus was manifest in many areas. One area was the fact that he would give shiurim at random hours. I remember when I was in yeshiva, they had a problem. People weren't coming to shacharis. It was 6:30 shacharis. And seder only, they had a halakha seder for 45 minutes after, and then they had breakfast, and seder was 8:30. So people were skipping shacharis, skipping halakha seder. So the aitzah was suggested, let's start seder earlier. They won't skip. We'll start seder at 8 o'clock. So Friday morning, he would give shir Friday, close to the Chiddush. Friday morning, 8 o'clock, he would give shir. You know, it's just, it's hard. And people came, they didn't want to miss the shir, so they would get up for Shacharis, and they would, you know, and they would come to the shir. He would give shir really challenging times. I heard, again, I wasn't in the shir at the time, but I heard that in the 60s, he wanted to go to Hassan Hafganah to help, you know, the Africans who were starving. He didn't want to miss the shir, so he told everybody to come at 6 o'clock, we'll down at 6, we'll give the shir from 7, and then we'll go after, meaning, when he was in the Yom Kippur War, he was going to go visit the soldiers in the front, and again, woke people up 4 in the morning. These are stories I heard from people, you know, I heard one story from Moshe, I heard from Hashi Billet, people who were there, who experienced these things. It's unbelievable, his amelus in giving shiurim. I heard from Yitzhak Cohen that when he was in the kollel in YU, so there was a power outage, and the room was dark. So everybody would go inside, you'd get something to eat. The Bookstein ran across the street, bought some candles, sat down, and you sit and learn with the candle. There's no power, we can't learn. Amelus was just amazing. And Amelus also was in the shir itself. So, you know, the fact that the shir was charted out from Chilat Sof, it takes a lot of time to prepare a shir like that. He wasn't just learning with the boys. I mean, he was learning with the boys, but he knew where he was going from Chilat Sof, and in the end, there was a sikkum. And the sikkum could last, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, where especially the shir kollel, he would outline exactly what he did. And that was a chance, you know, to catch up, to you know, miss something, you didn't realize how things put together, you just listen to sikkum carefully, try to make up, you know, that which, you know, at least for me, I didn't understand the first time around. And there's also a chazar shir later sometimes, for shir kollel, where you had another chance to try to fill in the missing links. I remember I was in the shir once when it was Friday morning, again, it was shir at 8 o'clock, that's mine, and somebody came to the back of the room, and made a siman to Rabbi Lichtenstein, and I guess he was expecting this phone call, and he said, oh, Slicha, you should telephone the Chuf, I have an important phone call. He went out of the room, this came back 7-8 minutes later, and he mamish continued to the exact spot of saying, I don't remember if it was mid-sentence or not, but it was mamish in terms of the train of thought, it was just unbelievable. And in terms of how many shirim he gave, I mean, it's just mind-boggling. The man, you know, Tuesday, he gave shir yomi at 8:30, generally it was 8:30. And then he would give chaburas at 11:30. And he'd give a shir kollel every second week after mincha. The shir kollel went for 2 hours, 2.5 hours. There was once in a shir kollel that I think went for almost 3 hours. Then it would come to gross. I think she used to give shir and gross on Tuesday. You know, the hashkafa shir for 45 minutes, an hour, and then a gemara shir for an hour and a half. You think how many hours a day a person gives shir. And this is after coming back from a plane, you know, jet lagged, and this is when you're sick, you have temperature. He once said that, you know, if basketball players can play when they have a little fever, so we can also learn Torah, you know, Chas V'Rosh, or Yas V'Torah. And he didn't just say it, he lived it. It was just an amazing, amazing thing to see. After he fell in 2007, broke his hip, and he didn't want to fast on the shiurim. You know, at that point, I'm not sure how much the people were getting out of it here in the yeshiva, frankly. But he wanted to give, and if there was one Talmud who wanted to take, he would give, and we had a hasa'ot to his home, and then he was coming with a walker, and when I saw him struggling with the walker, it reminded me of his Rebbe, Rav Yisrael Vejik, Zechatak Libracha, in YU. When I was in YU, he would come already, Meshutak, he was paralyzed, half his body had been paralyzed from a stroke, and he'd push himself, and he was like his Rebbe in that respect, in terms of his stubbornness to give shir, and his Avos HaTorah. I mean, I think it all flowed from his Avos HaTorah. If you weren't willing to work, it was very hard to understand this year. I appreciated your most was the second time around, or you know, after my first year in college, I came back to yeshiva, and learned Sechus Beit. I learned Beit a number of times, and I already knew the sugyas. So if you know the sugyas, or you heard it already once from him, then you could appreciate what he was doing. Then you can recognize the godless of how he dissected the sugya and organized the sugya. In a regular shiyomi, he'd give you Marim Kolmos. If you finished half of them, you were lucky, and you didn't really have a sense of what the sugya meant. So it was harder to really appreciate. I mean, ideally, you should go in understanding it, and then you know, understand how he understood it and compare and contrast. But it was harder for me, at least, when I knew the sugya well, and then I hear shir, I was really able to appreciate his godless. I was really able to appreciate the complexity of his thought, and that summer, when we learned Beitza, after my first year in college, I think they were the shiurim that I really appreciated the most, because I really was prepared the most for them, and I was also very excited to be back in yeshiva after having been in college for a year, and I really took most out of the opportunity. As I said before, he was willing to teach a number of students. He said here in this room that when he was in high school, Baron Soloveitchik, who schlepped down from Washington Heights to Flatbush to Klein Berlin to give shiur to a couple of boys. It was June's time, and there was very few people there, and he was a kabbalah himself at that point to give shiur even to a few number of students. And that's how he lived his life. I remember the first time I was in Ishir Yomi was Kaitzman of Tafshin Nun Vav, Lunar Pesachim, and he gave a bechin at the end of his man. And there were actually different tukufas in his career where sometimes he wouldn't give bechinas and he would give bechinas. He had different shitas about it. It was, you know, the milas and chitoras to having bechinas. And at that point, I guess they felt the boys needed it for their chazara. So he gave a bechina at the end of the man. And I remember leaving the bechina, realizing how much more I had learned from the bechina. Meaning, sometimes the bechina is okay, you ask the shitas and you spit out the shitas. But his bechina was trying to interconnect the various sugars we learned, and the various shitas in the Rishonim we learned, and the complexity allowed me to see what I had learned in a totally new light. I had done chazar, I thought I knew it well, and the bechina forced me to recognize how much deeper and how much more complex the limud had been when he interconnected the sugyas. And really, that's what this idea in Kol Torah Kulo, because, you know, a Bailan computer knows shas. But it doesn't understand, you know, and it knows all the shittas in Rishonim, but it doesn't have a havana of the interconnection, you know, lavi davar mitoch davar, to see the complexity, see the chakiras and afuminas. His yediyah haTorah was outstanding in that regard. And it wasn't just in Shas, it wasn't just in Zrayim and in Taras. I mean, his understanding of Machshavat Yisrael, I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, in Kabbalah he didn't learn, and he used to quote the Ramban in Akdama to Chumash, where, you know, Rachach Meimcha Al Tidrash, it's not for us. But except for Kabbalah, his Shlita was unbelievable. And again, they're Bikim, and there were people who were Bikim, greater Bikim than him, there's no question. But the Havana Amuka was something that was astonishing. He once said the difference between Kiyas and Iyun isn't how many Sfarim you open up. So, you know, the Kiyas, you learn Rashi Tosfos, and you learn Iyun, so you'll see the Pnei Yeshua, and you'll see the Ramban. You learn the same Rashi Tosfos, the same Rambam, but you're Ma'ayin in it, and you really have a deeper Havana. That's Iyun. And that's how he taught. His shiurim on Shabbos, and what the Shabbos, depending on the time of year, in the summer it was in Shabbos afternoon, in the winter was Shabbos afternoon, summer was Shabbos afternoon, and the winter was Motzei Shabbos, were opened our eyes to areas of Torah that we weren't accustomed to studying, to the Zrayim, and the Kachim, and the Taras, and it was amazing. It was especially when it was on in summer months, where you had to remember the whole shiur and try to figure out what the Shabbos, how it all put together, and it was just very challenging. I remember sitting with the Havruta, like, what did he say? How did he say it? And trying to like reconstruct the shiur. I once heard that Rav Aaron Kotler, that's how he used to give shiur on Shabbos, bedafka, in order to force the students to remember. And I remember having that experience of trying to sit and to really reconstruct the shiur. And those shiur were really amazing. As I said, all his Torah, all his amelos, stems from his Avodah Torah. The pasuk on outside the yeshiva says, "Ma Avodah Torah Secha Kol Yom Tichasi." I'm not sure who suggested to have it there, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was him. His Avodah Torah was palpable. I remember him screaming in a sicha, the Gemara in Sanhedrin and David, Amr Shmuel and Achmeini, "My Dechsiv Ayelas Ahuvim Yelas Chayin Lamanim Shnitiv Torah LaAyelas Lomach Ma'ayala Lecham Atzar V'Chaviv Al Bo'ala Kol Shav V'Shach K'Shav Yishona." Every time for him was Shari Shon. Every time was so exciting. And it was really, it wasn't just the intellectual learning, it was the Avat Hashem. I mean, he would quote the Rambam and he would tell us Shuvah that the way which we relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is through our knowledge of him. And the more we understand Torah, the more we understand the world, the more we can relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he was Doreis that we learned Lishma. I remember him saying, I couldn't believe it, I almost fell off my seat. He said, I'm jealous of Alabatin. Why am I jealous of Alabatin? a boss, Mincha Marek opens up Mishnayis, and you know, I don't know, Sefer Tchulin, and he learns a Mishnah. It's nothing to do with his job, nothing to do with Parnasa. He just learns Torah because he loves Torah. And when I learn, I'm praying a shir. Well, I'm praying a shir, so give a good shir. Tell me that will come. My Parnasa, my Yeshiva. He felt that Torah has to be Lishma, which it should be, and he recognized that sometimes Baal Basim have an easier time learning Lishma, which is an amazing thing for somebody to say, a Rosh Yeshiva of that stature, I'm jealous of Baal Basim. It's just, it's so true, but it's rarely stated, and I think rarely felt, frankly. But I think the primary reason he learned, you know, it wasn't just Avos Hashem, but it was because of the tzivut. He always emphasized that we relate to Kadosh Baruch Hu as mitzuve. Adam Rishon, Yitzav, Hashem Elokim et Adam. Adam related Kadosh Baruch Hu as a mitzuve, and we have a chiyuv to learn Torah. I remember he gave a very fiery drasha once. How people, you know, when they like learning, they come to learn, and when they like something else, they do something else. So he compared this to a relationship between marriage and zmus. Marriage through the thick and the thin. Zmus, when if you're interested, you're involved. And the fire again. Maybe I'll talk about the drushes. The drushes were a different nature. In the shiurim were the shiurim, and the drushes were the tichot, were a different nature, but he was sometimes mamish, fire and brimstone, eish lahava. Other times he was more poetry, but the tichot were really outstanding. I don't think people here in the kolo really had a chance to hear him. I mean, he had the truba drushes, which were amazing, but the tichot were really mostly on Shabbos, and once in a while on the weekdays in the yeshiva. But he could give 45 minutes tichot Friday night in Mincha Maariv, half the place tells us. And I remember fighting to stay awake. I would stand on the side of the Beis Medrash to try to stay awake, and he would develop a theme and the complexity. Think, you know, just every angle he would analyze it from so many aspects. It was just outstanding. And when you left the sikha, if you couldn't summarize it in 2 minutes, it means you didn't understand it, because he really was just trying to say one simple thing, but he was trying to explain how a simple thing had so many aspects. It was so complex, and if you couldn't summarize it in 2 minutes, you didn't understand it. But if you just would say in 2 minutes, you didn't appreciate the complexity of it. And it was really, it was unbelievable. I mean, I don't know, I haven't heard a darshan like that. I don't know if anybody here heard of Matthew Solomon from Lakewood. He has a presence. He stands up, and I don't know, now he's much older. When I heard him before the Yeshiva Bein HaSemester, I used to go to Lakewood in the winter, and I went there one summer, and to hear Matthew stand up, he was speaking Yiddish, and he'd stand there, and like he had command over the whole room. And it was like an amazing feeling. That's the only type of a speaker that I heard had a similar type of presence. His presence was really total and all-encompassing. Again, you have to want to be captivated. You have to listen. If you didn't listen, you fell asleep. But if you listened, you would be taken in by his presence. And like I said, sometimes he was very charif. He would eat with us by Shabbos day. Friday night he would eat with his family, and Shabbos day he would eat with us, and Shabbos Shulis also, and every meal there was always a different boy in the yeshiva would say a Dvar Torah, and sometimes people would say things he didn't like, and really didn't like, and if somebody would say a Dvar Torah by Shabbos lunch he didn't like, sometimes on the spot he would get up and give him a little mussar, but once in a while if he really didn't like it, he would wait till Shabbos Shulis, and he would give the whole Shabbos Shulis drasha about why this fellow said something that was inappropriate, and not to embarrass the fellow, but he very much appreciated creative thought. Sometimes when you're creative, you go off the deep end. So I remember once somebody gave a drasha about Yaakov and Emes, and the guy said, yeah, Yaakov needs Emes because he lied. So he cut up Shalosh Shulis. Wow. He gave him, he was quoting philosophers, he was quoting Rishonim, and it was just, every fiber of his being was screaming, you know, it's good to be creative, but do your research. And it was just, it was unbelievable. To hear him. He would also use humor in giving mussar. Remember once there were talmidim didn't show up to shakas. They had in the building, they had the yeshuv had a later minyan. It was 9 o'clock shakas minyan. Our minyan was 7:30 sometimes. And they had a 9 o'clock minyan. So Shabbos lunch, towards the end of lunch, boys who davened 9 o'clock minyan would come in. And he got up and he said, notice last night the Beis Hamikdash was full. This morning, there were a number of people who weren't here. Then I realized that in the morning we have a sikkin. So for all those who don't have a sikkin, you should know the Mordechai in Shabbat says that even if you don't have a sikkin the whole week, you can don't have a sikkin on Shabbat. And it was that type of humor, that sarcasm, he was able to give mussar in a way that people wouldn't cobble it, I think, a little bit more than just, you know, fire and brimstone. Sometimes he had a, you know, remember when people wouldn't come back from, let's say, Shabbat, they'd come back, you know, 10 o'clock Sunday morning, 11 o'clock. So,
didn't know. He looked at the schedule. The buses run Motzei Shabbos. He didn't know. They run Motzei Shabbos. People should be, you know, that type of sarcasm was sometimes used, you know, in the Sikhot. Remember one time the government wanted to see if the boys were indeed in yeshiva. You get a certain amount of money, be more per student. So they, you know, they didn't have emails, but they put up a sign, everybody should be here, you know, Thursday. I don't think it was a surprise. They said the next few days somebody's going to come, people should be here. And Taka, all the boys, were 99% of the boys who were registered, who showed up and, you know, showed them that's a hoot, and the yeshiva was fine. Next day he gets up, in the middle of the Seder, gives a sicha. He starts screaming at the top of his lungs. Says, Kevin Shakir, Shabarakul Vesa Medrish, Lomhasa Shamasara, do we need the government to tell us to be here? He says, he quotes the Pasuk in Yirmiya, right? Hamarat Pitsim, Haya Bait Adeh. It was so powerful. The Otma of his drashas when he was, again, I heard him more in Hebrew. The Trupa drashas, he was speaking to an older crowd, and he was speaking in English. I don't know if it was the same Otma, but his Sichot, the young boys in Hebrew, were really very powerful. And he was always mechadish. He was always mechadish in his Sichot. He once told me that, you know, if you give the same shiur again and again, you become old very quickly. And he told me, even in learning, you have to be mechadish, and he told me if he even tries to go through the sugya again, it's just, it was all so worked out for him, so in Mele he came to the same askanah. He knew the chakiras, and he would relearn it, but it would always be the same. But he always felt like his work ethic was unbelievable. He would go through the sugya again, and in Sikhas, every time he go through it again, he finds a new Havana. I remember once we were in the Shabbaton in Chutzlaretz, and they told him he has to give a Dvar Torah, like a 25 minute between the Kiddush and the lunch, and he wasn't aware of that. So he apologized, he got up, he said, sorry, I wasn't aware that I had to give a Torah, I'm going to take something out of the freezer, he said, something from his memory, I hope it's not freezer burnt. And he gave a Torah, it was amazing drasha, and he would have thought that he wasn't prepared, but he never relied on that, he always prepared a Mechadash. Again, certain themes he repeated, but those themes were close to his heart, he thought they were educationally valuable, but he would constantly strive to be Mechadash. And he, in his drashas and his sikhot, really demanded the students to try to affect other people, to try to become rabbani mechanchim, try to be osik b'shub shal olam, to really make a difference. I remember when I was in yeshiva, so I was influenced by him. Part of the reason I'm in chinuch is because of him. He encouraged us, and we picked up those vibes, and we wanted to go into chinuch. And my mother was concerned, maybe. I wouldn't be such a good mechanic. So when my mother came to visit me, she sat with him in his home in Katamon, and he said to her, some people, they're natural. My father-in-law, put him in the first grade, he captivates his kids. The other people, it just doesn't work. It's like teaching a bear how to dance. So, I don't know if it's like somewhere from English literature, it's just an expression. He said, oh yeah, if he's somewhere with the middle, I think if he studies education, maybe he'll be a decent teacher. But he really wanted people to go into chinuch. He wanted people to be involved in the world of Kodesh. And he said, even if you're not going to be involved in Kodesh, at least you should be doing something like Shubha Shalom. Be a doctor, try to help people. True, we need investment bankers. But, when you're an investment banker, what are you doing for for the world? Again, people need to invest their money, but it's not the same. Sometimes when he would give drashas, I mamash felt like he was talking to me. Now, this is a phenomenon that, Hasidim usually have. You feel like the Rebbe is like talking to you. And I was a Chassid, I have to admit, I am a Chassid. But I remember one time, I had some very complicated shayla in Hichos Nedarim, a Halacha L'maisa shayla, and it was Parshas Matos. And he got up that Friday night, and he started screaming at the top of his lungs about the Gaiva, and the person takes a Neder. And he was like going on and on. And I mamash felt like he was giving me Musar. And I think he was. I mean, I don't know if he had Kavanah for that particular thing, but for me it was Musar. As a Masbid, it was amazing to hear his Hespedim. He could really describe the character and the personality of the Nifter. He didn't deal well with these expressions like the Gaon and the Tzaddik and the Gadol Dor. He wanted to understand who the person was. He would always speak about how he was a Ravaran Cutler's Levaya, and none of them Hespedim really captured him, except for one Balabot who really described him as a person. In terms of his davening, I remember watching Davin Yom Kippur. I remember standing there for hours and hours bent over. And then at the end of Yom Kippur, turning around and starting to dance with Rabbi Tal, Tikkun Lebracha, see the simcha on his face. It was unbelievable. He had a special niggun for Birchas Torah. He really felt in every fiber of his being, saying Birchas Torah, B'chor Banim, Kol Amin, his Kaddish, Tekiyas. It was really see his when he was a makri of Tekiyas, see the power. You know, mamish, every fiber of his being was calling out. It was really inspirational. Once I asked him about davening, have someone in davening. I said to him, Rebbe, you know, I really tried, but you know, I'm not so successful. Maybe I should, lower my expectations. Maybe I should daven a little faster and just have a simple kavana. And hopefully, you know, for 2 minutes I can speed through davening. At least I'll be able to say, you know, the basic kavanas. And he said to me, first of all, he showed compassion. He said to me, Tosfos in Chagiga, Tosfos in Yerushalmi, Moraim had problem with kavana. He said to me, what you're suggesting would sacrifice the life of the patient to save a limb. Davening is a basic religious need. Okay, so you try to have kavana, and sometimes you end up elsewhere. But you have to try. And he was very, very compassionate, but at the same time, very, very real about the difficulty with kavana and the need to try as best we can. I mean, the Beidim, you know, his daughter speaking about it was an ambulance. You know, Biyatcha Afid Ruchi, Padisei Osi Hashem Kelamet. It was an amazing description. Again, I wasn't there, but just hearing about it, you know, makes me shiver. On the Modas Avel that the family put out, they wrote he was Keben Hamitzchatel in the Avi Shoshayim Tzviwa. And those who know, you know, he had a daughter-in-law who had cancer, and Baruch Hashem, she's fine. They told her she wouldn't have any children after, and Baruch Hashem, she had more children. He had a son who had cancer. He had a lot of tzaras, and Talmidim's tzaras affected him. I remember asking him once after the summer, you know, how was your summer? So he was telling you he had a Talmud who his daughter had cancer, passed away. And that affected him. And Kaisel started affecting him. His daughter said that she would call him on the phone, and if something was going on politically in the country, you could hear his voice. And you know, I once heard Rabbi Soloveitchik said that you should listen to the news because you have to know what to daven for. And, you know, Muslims listen to the news because it's a pastime. You know, it's, instead of watching baseball, so we watch the news. But he viewed it as a religious act to know what to daven for. His davening was very, very emesic. I remember when my mother, Allah Shalom, was sick, so I was going to the Kotel. I went once to the Kotel. It was very meaningful. I wanted to go every week. And then I missed the week, so I was going to go twice. And he said to me, you're going to go twice, you know, a lot of things to do, maybe it's not such a good idea. Why don't you call Rav Aaron? So I called Rav Aaron, and he said to me, you have to go to the Kotel because you want to go to the Kotel. You shouldn't go to the Kotel because you have to go. He was very emphatic about davening. Davening is a relationship with Kodesh Baruch Hu, and the minute you have to do it, so the relationship isn't the same relationship. It has to be emphatic. It has to be a real... In terms of his complexity of thought, I don't think you can underestimate how complex he thought through things. He was a genius. There are a lot of geniuses, but he saw everything in such a complex way, and that was clear in the shiurim and the drashas. But it was true about everything he did. There were never easy answers to complex questions. I remember one time there were some young boys in high school who came to the yeshiva. They used to have like it was called the shavua yeshiva. You come to spend a few days, see if this yeshiva is matim for you. So they had an onuk Shabbos Friday night. So I figured I'd go see how he interacts with the high school boys, the 11th grade boy. So the kid raises his hand, says, Rebbe, I think it was an American boy, said, I'm studying here for the year. My parents gave me permission to study in Israel for the year. And I want to make Aliyah. I want to stay, finish high school. My parents don't want me to, so I'm allowed to go against my parents' wishes to stay here. So we really start talking about the nation of Kibbutz Aim, and then the kid, after about 3-4 minutes, the kid cuts him off, says, Lizlichin, Kano Law. Very loud to go against the parents' wishes. So a little bit, you know, he had discussed the Kibbutz Aim that he was going to talk about Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael. He was going to compare the two and analyze the difference and the nachuminas. And a little bit turns to him, he says, Nimetzia, I suggest that you take this word, the word Kano Law, out of your lexicon. And again, he wasn't mean to him, but he just tried to explain to him, things are complex. He said, A, post-secrecy, maybe there's no serious post-neg, we'll give you a yes or no answer to this question. Of course, the sad thing is, there are many post-kim who are considered serious post-kim, and they are serious post-kim. Who would give a yes or no question to this question, to this yes or no answer to this type of question? But it looks like he was not a yes or no type of person, he was complex. And everything had to be analyzed, you have to understand the tzadim and the notifications of everything. And this idea of complexity affected his talmidim not only in their learning, not only in their shavuot ha'olam, but in general. You know, I felt after leaving yeshiva that I had the kelim to deal with life in a more significant way. I had the ability to analyze issues that can't come up. He was merely ma'amid talmidim. He gave him the ability, the kelim, to learn, the kelim, to think, the kelim to be avdei Hashem. Remember when we just got married, or just before we got married actually, Dean and I were discussing, you know, various hanhagas, chumras that I had, and she didn't necessarily want to take on. So I asked the local thing, if it's necessary that Dee takes all my chumras. And I was concerned also about, you know, objectively, is there a chiyuv for a wife to shtab with her husband in that regard? And secondly, in terms of children, further down along the line, you know, is it complicated or, you know, confusing for kids? You know, if they see that Abba doesn't open these bottles on Shabbos, and he does, v'chulei, v'chulei. So Rosh Chodesh said to us, he said, firstly, in terms of the halakhic issue, he doesn't think that there's a chiyuv, that a woman takes on her husband's hanhagas. He said that Moshe Soloveitchik's wife didn't take on the brisker chumras, or the brisker kulas for that matter. Once he saw her in the kitchen, and she was doing something with shinui, and the brisker told his mother, he only needs a shinui, she said, I don't take that kulas either. So then he said to me that in terms of, you know, the issue of education, he said you have to educate towards complexity. It's good that the kids know there's Moshe holds as a certain Shulam holds mutter, and Abba holds like Moshe, and he holds a Shulam, and that's something that is educationally valuable. Now, I think many people have a hard time with this, and you have to know how to do it, but that idea of educating towards complexity is something that he believes in, and he educated his own children that way, as he told me. Before I sent my first daughter, my oldest daughter, to school, to Kita Aleph, so we checked out a lot of different types of educational options, different hashkafas, different styles, and I sat with him, and I asked him, how come the places that have, you know, more Yerushamayim don't teach the kids how to think, and vice versa, the more they think, the less they have Yerushamayim. So he first took issue with that whole, you know, description. He didn't think it was necessarily true. He said, Yerushamayim, everything, you just have to listen to everything the Rebbe says, that's Yerushamayim. And then he said to me a very silly thing. He said, which is something I struggle with today, and it's a serious issue. He said, look, if you want to educate people to be independent, then you have to recognize that there's sometimes a price you pay for it. Because the minute you don't want the kid to be a tukey, to just replicate everything the Rebbe says, so at that point you're already opening the possibility the kid is going to be creative. So you tell a kid, you want you to be creative in thinking, but don't think about kfira, because that you shouldn't be creative about that. So it's a tightrope. And I think that complexity is something that he tried to educate towards, to recognize, to, on one hand, try to make students, you know, be creative, and sometimes they're too creative to, you know, pull in the other direction. And that was something, I think, that because of his complexity, he was able to stomach. And many people have a hard time with that. Many people prefer to avoid that model because of the dangers that lie within it. He never put down complex questions. He never tried to make things, sugarcoat things. There were challenging issues in Hashkafa that people had that he listened to, and sometimes he'd say, I don't know. That was his honesty. Sometimes he would try to answer to the best of his ability. I had a friend who learned with me for 3 years in yeshiva who went off to Cambridge and went off to Derech. And Lichtenstein went with England. He wanted to see the Ksav Yad of the Rambam. And the student took him to see the Ksav Yad in the university. And the student was Gili Rosh, and it caused Lichtenstein a lot of pain. I didn't hear directly, but my understanding was it caused him a lot of pain. But this is a student. I didn't know this person was from today. He wrote a Hesped of Rarion. And these are the words he writes. And I'm happy, I mean, I was with Yeshiva's fellow for 3 years, very bright guy. He writes like this: in my own experience, however, the time when I was really struggling with my Judaism when he was in college, I found him to be above all compassionate and non-judgmental. As he spoke at length about the intellectual existential difficulties I was having, he communicated tremendous sympathy with my plight, and characteristically did not pretend to have easy answers to my problems. But there was something more, something warm and encouraging, as if he could see in my troubled soul that something good was trying to work its way out. That this was not a meaningless and angry rebellion, but a necessary stage of my development. It was almost as if his faith in me allowed me to have faith in myself, to feel that I was actually engaged in something meaningful, and my better self had not been entirely duped. And eventually this fellow came around and is doing good things for the Jewish people. As his daughter, Tony, said at the Levaya, he taught us that things are so complicated and yet so simple at the same time. And I think it's a very profound statement that is very true. In terms of his midos, you can speak. I just wanted to speak briefly about a number of his main midos, at least from my perspective. I should mention that with his 80th birthday, they made a video about him. And some of his Talmidim spoke about him. And everybody spoke about his midos. So when they showed the video just to the family, he turned to his daughter, Esti. He said, "What about my shiura? People are just talking about midos." So I heard the story from somebody who was there, who heard this firsthand. And his daughter cleverly said to him, "Ava, what was harder for you, to work on your midos or your shiura?" And when I heard that, I thought it was the story of Rishon answer, that it's easier to learn all shas than it is to change one midah. And he really was the person who worked with midahs. He really was the person who had a sterling character. Just in terms of some of the main midahs, in terms of Anava, he was a real Anav. And, you know, people can try to be Anav, but trying to be an Anav is a simon you're not an Anav. You know, a real Anava is inherent. It's very hard to work on, because the minute you try to work on it, it's very artificial. But he really was an Anav. He really didn't view himself better than anybody else. Look, he ran a yeshiva together with somebody who was from a different background, and he disagreed on a lot of issues with Rav Mital. They had a lot of mutual respect, but there was a lot of issues that they disagreed about. But they disagreed with Tuf Tam and Dinachas, and together they were able to run the yeshiva. And there were many things in the yeshiva that were not l'rucho. You know, there's a college next to the yeshiva. The way to learn Tanakh there is not exactly the way he would learn Tanakh. But he respected other people's opinions because of his anava. Look, Rav Mital offered him to be the Rosh Yeshiva, and he himself said he wanted to be a Kol Rosh Yeshiva. He didn't feel, you know, that it was ethical to take away from Rav Mital. He, after all, started the yeshiva. That was anava. Remember, they once asked him about going up to Har HaBayis. So this is a halachic issue, you know, do we know exactly where the Azara is, the Safik is a Karet. But he said, even if you're convinced that you're not going to go in an area that you think is problematic, the Pasuk says, Miyalev Har Hashem, Niki Kapayim Valeva. I don't know if I'm holding there. I don't know if I'm holding there. And there were Rabbanim in Yeshiva who were his students who would encourage people to go to Har HaBayis, and he didn't speak out against them. It's amazing enough. And it wasn't just about his students. It was about people who were, you know, in Western thought. He just had tremendous, he really, you know, was Mekayim, Kabelat, Amet, Misha Mara, and he was really willing to learn and from anybody. Even people who had very different values. So somebody learned, he was willing to be machni himself to learn from them. I remember here in the yeshiva at the Shloshim for Avraham Soloveitchik, Rav Miller had finished speaking, he was introduced to Rabbi, and he didn't want there to be like a long introduction, so he basically stood up and walked right away to the podium, was on the downstairs auditorium, and Rav Miller kind of motioned to him that he should sit down because he wanted to introduce, you know, the Shkola, and he just stood there. So Rav Miller very quickly, briefly, honored to have the book of scene, and he was there. He didn't want people to stand up for them because, you know, they were sitting at a table, you know, it was Dr. Applebaum, Shemi Komdamo, and the other Masvidin, and he didn't want people to stand up for him, so he stood there right next to Rav Miller in order that people shouldn't have to stand up. His anava was just genuine. I remember at the Jewish Center, one of the Shabbatanim, we would follow around where he would speak, so he spoke one at the Jewish Center, so we davened the Ashkala Minyan in OZ, and we walked down to the Jewish Center, and Rabbi Ari Berman, who was a close Talmud of his, gave a beautiful haktama, about 10 minutes flowery, you know, something you do at the Jewish Center. With the, and Rav Aaron sat there. Babish, you could look at him if he was just so embarrassed to be there. And he got up, he started giving instructions. He didn't take Rabbi Berman, even though he had a lot of respect for him, because I think he just felt it was like all sheker. He couldn't deal with the 10 minutes of laying it on thick, and it was just, his hanava was very, very, very real. But his hanava wasn't limited to interpersonal relations. His hanava was also intellectual hanava. As I said before, you know, a different Rav is a different shita, but going up to Harbayis, you know, I can respect that. Even though he disagreed with it. He would say, I don't know, many times. I remember speaking to him many times about personal etzas and in learning. He would say, I don't know, but with a sense of, with genuine humility. Like, it's just, when Yoni Jezner, Hashem Yikom Damo, was killed since the yeshiva, his body was still alive, they knew he wouldn't make it, they wanted to know if they could give organs. The question of whether or not he's still alive is a halakha question. He had brain death and he was on a respirator and other machines, and the family asked him if he could donate organs. And the Lichtenstein told them they could make a decision. The Rabbanut Paskin is Mutter based on Ravadia, based on the Rav Moshe's family's version of Rav Moshe's Shita, and that's a legitimate Shita, although there are others who think it's Safek Rishticha. And they did donate the organs in the end. And a close Talmud asked him after, what would he have done had he been in that situation? And he said he wouldn't have been able to allow it. But he said, I can't pass him vados against Rav Moshe, against Rav Avad, against Rabbanut, especially when there are people who, their lives can be saved from this. So he, if they would ask me, I would say, Safek Rishticha, how can he move? And he himself would have done that way, but he didn't think it was appropriate passing the vados against Rav Moshe, against Rav Avadia, and therefore he gave the family the leeway to act. I remember I used to drive him home from the Kollel the last couple of years, and Rabbi Emanuel Rachman was a very important rabbi in America for many years, and then in Israel, he's involved in YU and Bar Ilan. He had passed away, and Lichtenstein was saying how he went to pay a shiva call. Apparently, he had helped the Rav a number, and the Rebbetzin, the Rav's wife in many ways, and an important person. And he paid a shiva call. And then I asked him a little bit of chutzpah. I said to him, Rebbe, how do you relate to somebody who, on one hand, did so many amazing things? At the same time, he was involved towards the end of his life with trying to help Agunas, and he tried to implement the Hafkas Kedushin idea that some have written about, Ray Riskin wrote about it, but he didn't actually implement it. Ray Rachman tried to implement it, and he was mocking a woman to get married without a guest, based on Hafkas Kedushin and Mechas Tos and things of the like. And I said to him, Debbie, how do you relate? On one hand, he's an amazing person, did so many good things. At the same time, look what he did, he's mocking Eish Dish. He said to me, I don't know if there's ever a time to express those sentiments. Certainly not after a person's no longer here. And I persisted. I was young and foolish. He said, Rebbe, how could he say that? He said to me, he was doing L'Shem Shemayim. The first Mitzvah L'Shem Shemayim, even though the sheet that you don't agree with, you talk about Chomer issues. You talk about Safek Rishticha, Eved Shishish. First Mitzvah L'Shem Shemayim, he had an intellectual anava recognizing the sheet that's more complex than presented generally. Now this Midah of Anava, I think, was the Shoresh for many other Midahs. The Ramban writes, of course, in the Geret, that Anava is the first Midah that one needs to, or primary Midah that one needs to work on. And I think that his sensitivity to others flowed to a large extent from his Anava. He had a tremendous sensitivity to other people, to all people, to Goyim, to Jews. I remember once there was a airplane that crashed, and they originally thought there were Jews on the plane, in terms of no Jews, and he was asked, how do you relate to it? He said, they were sad. If there were Jews, we'd have more sad. The fact that they found that there are no Jews, it's a person. He said, Moshe Rabbeinu was solving of Yisro, being taken advantage of. He didn't say, a bunch of shiksas. But Yaakov Moshe v'Yoshiyan, the Yashket Sonam. He cared, and this is how he lived his life. In the 60s, he went to the Hafganot for the Africans, and he, throughout his, even when Sonny Israel in Lebanon, were being murdered, a person is a person. Uh, I remember once I walked into the shtiebel in Katamon with him. It was during 3 weeks. It was like Erev Tisha B'Av or day before Tisha B'Av. And there were two people arguing about some halacha in the 3 weeks, some basic halacha. So one of them said, "Bonne Shabbat of Lichtenstein." And Lichtenstein saw this, and he didn't want to embarrass the fellow. It was a simple halacha. One of them just making a mistake. He goes over to Mishabura, figured out. He said, "Ah, Mavati Shabbati." He didn't want to, it was partly his anava, but also I think it was his sensitivity. He didn't want to, you know, one guy was trying to prove the other guy wrong. After Lichtenstein, he didn't want to be involved in any type of, insult to somebody else. The 70th birthday, he read the Rambam, Hilchos Talmud Torah, Kashev Shetalminu Chayavim Bichor Chavad Rav, Kach HaRav Tzarech L'Chaviyah Talmidav, U'L'Karv, and Kach HaMul Chachamim, Yikvot Talmid Chachaviyah Lech Shalcha, Tzarech Adam L'Yizar V'Talmidav V'Lahoavam, Shehem Abonim HaMahanim La'olam Hazev L'Habah. He really viewed his students as his Talmidim, and he said at that point, he said, you have to love your Talmidim, not because it says in the Rambam, because of the relationship. He says, are you going to love your wife? Because it says in the Gemara you should love your wife? It's because of the relationship. And he loved all Talmidim. There was a Talmud he had who went off a derech, who asked him to Masada Kedushin, and it was very painful for him. But he said, look, if it was my son, I would Masada Kedushin. And he really loved his Talmidim. After he was Nifter, Adi and I had a conversation about putting up a picture of him in our home. And Adi's not into Gedolin pictures. I would be very happy if we had a picture of Shlomo Zalman in my house. I'm very happy with a picture of Ari Levine and other Gedolin. But Adi doesn't want pictures of the Golem in the house for various reasons. But she said to me, I want a picture of Rabbi, because he wasn't just the Gadol, he's Mishpacha. And I really feel that. And he's there next to my brother. He had a Talmud who ended up in jail for misconduct in NCSY, and he contacted him. He wanted him to visit him. And Rav Aaron had a very busy schedule in America, very busy. And he made it his business to get to the prison to speak to his Talmud. He had tremendous honor for his Talmudim, no matter where they were. I once asked him, how do you relate to people like this who are Rabbanim, who end up doing terrible things? And he said to me, you relate to them with respect. The person's out of, he paid his debt to society, he served his time. He said, Shalom Aleichem to him. You know, he had tremendous, tremendous respect for people. Even people who sinned. Again, Chassid Shalom, he wasn't condoning what they did, but in terms of the respect of a person, as a person, it was really amazing. And you contrast that to Pollard, for example. I once asked him about Pollard. He said to me, my Rebbe, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, was most nervous to visit him, and he spoke so highly of him. And Rav Aaron had a hard time. He never went to visit him. He had a hard time. He said, look, he spied in his own country, and for money. And as Rav Aaron's like ethical, again, not that the other person did something that was ethical, but like just, you know, a person sins, and he does tshuva, and he had tremendous respect for people. Again, I don't want to be misunderstood. I will not be misunderstood. And his sensitivity allowed you to really sit and talk to him. And even though he was very busy, he would give you as much time as he wanted. And you really felt that there was nothing else for him to do, which was an amazing thing, because he was really, really very busy. I remember after my son Matanel was born, so my grandmother, Shbiwell, insinuated that maybe we should name him after my grandfather, Olav HaShalom. And Adi didn't really like the idea of naming our child after somebody she didn't know, and he sat with us for a half an hour on the phone. It was the middle of the Lebanon War, and his Talmidim were in the army. I think some of his kids were in the army at the time. People were dying, mamish, and we were calling him about a name. And he sat with us, and he spoke to us, gave us mamish. It was just, it's amazing how much care and concern and love he showered upon his Talmidim. He was just very sensitive to their needs. I can speak for hours. I'm not going to, but there's a lot more stories in this regard. I remember his sensitivity wasn't only to people; it was also how people interact with halacha, which is, I think, a very important point. I remember a couple of weeks after my mother passed away, my brother had a baby boy, and there's a din in Shulchan Aruch comes from Yerushalmi that Kevan Shenola Ben Zachar Nir Pa'akol Hamishpacha Kol Osam Mishpacha. Which seems to indicate, because interesting, why Shulchan Aruch breaks it down, But it seems to indicate that after a child is born, a male child is born to the family, the avelus changes on some level. And I asked him if I have to feel that way. And he says to me, you know, avelus comes in waves, it's true, there's shiv and shloshi and there's kodesh, and it's nice if it all works like clockwork. It's sometimes like waves, and sometimes you don't feel it, and they feel it a lot. And he told me how his mother passed away a couple of months before his son, Rav Moshe's wedding. And the Levi was at sunset, they were waiting for his sister to come in, they were able to get the Levi in right before sunset, and by his son's chasna, looking into the sunset, all he saw was his mother's Levi. And he said to me, you know, here it is, the most sameach time of your life, your child's wedding, and you're thinking about your mother's Levi, and things, you know, he had compassion, he was very sensitive to people's interaction with halacha. I remember talking to him once about the story in Ish Halacha, how Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was a Makri, and the Baal Tokeya, the Chabad Chassid, was crying for tears, and Rav Moshe turns to him and he says, why are you crying? Do you cry? Do you shake lulav? And Rav Aaron told me, he thinks it's a terrible story. He said, I have tremendous respect for Rav Moshe. How can you take away a person's feeling of connection to Kadosh Baruch Hu? And he said, he told me he was a virar if it really happened. He didn't even believe the story happened. He found out, you know, what surely happened that, as I heard Rav Soloveitchik once said that he thought the Moshe was concerned it was going to ruin the tzkiyas. He wasn't upset about the regesh, he was just absurd. He thought that it would ruin the neshimas and the tzkiyas. But he had tremendous sensitivity. And his sensitivity affected the way he paskins. First of all, the fact that he passed himself as a chiddush. There are many Rosh Hashivas today, it's popular that, you know, I'm a Rosh Hashiva, I only deal with homes, I don't pass in halacha. Which I think is a terrible thing, but it's very popular today. Partially a function of, you know, the fact that we have big yeshivas, which is a good thing, but the fact that Rosh Hashivas are not connected to the tzibur and therefore don't have to pass in chaylas is, of course, a negative reality. But Rav Lichtenstein rolled up his sleeves and paskin on issues like abortion, issues, brain death issues. He was really willing to take the time. Again, people often had to press him, and he wouldn't get back, you know, for a number of weeks. So you really had to want to know what he thought in order to get an answer, because he was very busy. But he did paskin. But when he paskin, he was sensitive to other people. He really, this is like Rosh Hashanah, he spoke about this, how Rosh Hashanah thought that it can't be that a person with a hearing aid, you know, you can't speak to him on Shabbos, because speaking to him is like speaking to the microphone. Maybe you shouldn't speak to the person. The person's deaf and you can't speak to him, can't be. He thought that the halacha has to take into consideration the other people's feelings, and he very much was aware of the need for sensitivity of insight. I asked him similar questions at different points in my life that he gave me different answers to because of the sensitivity. When I was just a young yeshiva bachur, I was working in a summer camp, and they took the boys to Eilat. And I thought, the shayla of Yisrael, the chutz la'aretz shelo tzarech, even for Yisrael. And I'm a kohen, so it's the shayla of tumas eretz ha'amin. So I asked him, and he said, I should try to get out of it. And I did. And then a couple of years ago, Adi wanted to go to Mitzvah Ramon for Hanukkah vacation, which is a little more north, but it's also probably outside the gvulos of Eretz Yisrael. And I asked him, and he said to me, in Chutz La'aretz, so many years, now you're worried about Tumas Eretz Ha'amin? So I said to him, well, I live here now. I said, I'm concerned about it, you know, with vacation and other places. So he said, how much does Adi want it? So I said, she really wants to go to Sarah Hood. It's apparently very beautiful. She said, if she wants it, you should go. So the same question, you know, but the question is, are you a single blocker who can get out of a trip to Eilat? Or are you a married man with a wife and a family, and you know, and those types of shikulim were significant to him. Not all poskim would take those things into consideration. Agav, he told me that he once wanted to go on vacation with his wife, they wanted to go to Rome, so he was also concerned about this issue of Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz. So he stopped off in England to give a shir to be Torah Selim Torah. And he said that he had learned so much about Avodah Zarah in Rome that he didn't think it was necessary. I wasn't sure what he meant by learning about Avodah Zarah or just... anyway, he was also concerned about these issues, but he knew how to value, you know, human sensitivity and integrate that into the psak. I remember once I was in the yeshiva, it was Mashan Aleph. So I had a friend who was a Kohen who would always put on a talis before duchening. So he went to and he said, look, I put on a talis before duchening, you know, maybe I should just wear a talis from the beginning of Shacharis. He had bought a talis. And he said, yeah, a talis. And then he told another friend who was a Kohen, oh, Rav Lechazi said you should wear a talis. So he went to Rav Lechazi and said, Apitam, you don't have to wear a talis, you know, you put on for Dukhane. So they came back together and he said, to me you say Shmag for Dukhane, and for you, you tell me to wear it. The way you asked the question, you were excited about the mitzvah of tzitzit, and I told you, if your parents don't mind, it's certainly a mitzvah to wear a talis, so wear it from the beginning of davening. And you asked if it's a chiyuv, so of course it's not a chiyuv. And he very much took into consideration where the person's coming from and how they're asking the question, and in turn, they gave an appropriate psak. I remember once, some pressure in the family to visit, you know, challenging, we're already living there to Israel. I asked them to what extent, you know, do the family's expectations funnel or affect the Kibbutz Rav Eim Shabbo? And he said to me, he said, many tell me he was already in his 70s. It was very hard for him to get around a little bit. He said, there's somebody who will come and ask him Tzadik Kiddush. And I tell him, I'll think about it, you know, I'll get back to you. And, you know, because I know it's hard. And, you know, they'll come one more time. I'll tell them, like, I'm not sure. And then they'll leave me alone. I would tell him, Adam, they'll come to me every day. After the Talmidim who have more respect, I have more of a kesher with. I would have loved to be at his class enough, but he had enough respect to recognize it's challenging for me to come from a lunch with the Tel Aviv from the Sadat Kedushin. The fellow I have less of a kesher with, who wants his Rosh Hashiva to be there, asked me again. And I end up going to his class enough, not because I have more of a relationship with him, but I see it's so important to him. So if it's so important to him, and he doesn't have enough derech eretz to recognize that it's hard for me, so I'll go to his class enough. He said, it's your parents or in-laws feel a certain way, even if the expectations are out of place. You have to, you know, balance, and you have to sometimes deal with people, Basher Husham. Once asked him a very, very complicated, sensitive shaila, and he gave me a heter, and I felt very bad about it, and I called him the next day, and he said, Rebbe, you know, I don't feel comfortable with this, and he says to me, look, I'm not telling you the heter is glass, but in your circumstances, I think this is the appropriate thing to do. And when he said that to me, it really gave me the ability to be maker, which I think was the right decision. And then, since 2-3 years, I haven't been able to consult with him, I had also a very complicated question, and I asked one of the Gedolei Zohar, and the answer was the Shas of Tchak of Shala Akel. And I had the same problem, but I couldn't go back to him and tell him, Rebbe, I don't feel comfortable with this, and I couldn't, and he wouldn't tell me I should be maker. And I was stuck, and I wasn't able to make it, and it was a difficult situation. I asked Mishaila once, we were stopping early to help Adi in the morning on the Sigin, they had a minyan non-shul store in Chol Lev, minyan Mitzumtzum. And I was the only Kohen. And up the hill, there's a Sephardi minion. It's happened very nicely, very slowly. And they had a lot of Kohanim there. So there's a din that because Kohanim is only the right with 2 Kohanim. So I was wondering, I said to them, one hand, they can have with the Sephardim, they're because Kohanim in the Torah. Or I could daven over here, but I'll be the only Kohen. Here, it's the Beis Medrash, you know, daven in the Beis Medrash, maybe that will trump this. He says to me, I understand. The minyan mitzumtzum. So they appreciate that you come. And you're the only Kohen. Well, where does Gemilas Chassamim factor into this? You should daven with the minyan mitzumtzum because you're going to help make the minyan and you're going to be the only Kohen. That itself is a value. You're thinking about your mitzvah and a Torah of duchening. Here's why he thinks it's a chalos shame duchening, even if it's not a chiyuv, there's a chalos shame with one Kohen. And the Gemilas Chassamim, it was just amazing. And then I persisted. I said to him, sometimes mom is only 10 people. And some of them are from Ethiopian descent, and I don't know exactly whether they're Miskaya or not. And again, I don't even understood. He's tremendous. He sat on the Va'ada with Rav Avadia at the time, he told me, to decide the status of Ethiopian Jewry. And Rav Avadia was very harif that they should declare them as Jews based on the Radbaz. Vilkosin was more hesitant. He says to me, when it comes to Dinim Durabanan, Kavod Abrios, it's poshut that you should starve them to Armenia. Kavod Abrios and Drabanan, Pasha. But I want to make something very clear, and I think sometimes this was misunderstood. The fact that he was sensitive didn't allow him to cross any line. P'ki was that. There were certain ekronot that were red lines that for him You were Yarav Yavor. I remember once asked him about discussing Gilad Shalit, going to free 1,000 terrorists for one Jewish soldier, and he was Harif. He said he had tremendous sensitivity. He just thought it was a mistake, and it's a mistake. So how can you do such a thing? He said that when Rav Hunna was hijacked and is in Jordan, so they asked him, Yaakov was sensitive, should be sensitive. And how can you do such a thing? You're going to, you know, this Gemara thing, again, Ravadi had his own Shita, Ravadi disagreed, passing his mutter, but his Ekronot were Chad v'chalak. I remember a couple of years ago, there was a boy in the Yeshiva College who wrote an anonymous letter. He was homosexual. And I read the letter, and it really disturbed me. It was just, you know, philosophically, it's just hard to understand why Kadosh Baruch Hu does these things. And I asked him about it, and his sensitivity was amazing. He had so much sensitivity, and he added to it. He said, "Look, think of the parents. He knows parents of students like this, and the parents how they're broken." But he says, "Halacha is halacha, and you can't put your tithes over halacha." And his sensitivity didn't allow him, chas v'shalom, to be swayed, accused on dinim, on things that were clear-cut, things that were unequivocal. I remember at one point when I was working here, they had a lot of budgetary issues in YU, they still do, and at that point they told me that I wouldn't be able to continue in my position here. So I went to speak to them about the different options, and he had this idea and that idea, and they said to me, you know, sometimes, you know, things aren't done so scientifically. It's not like they, you know, put an ad in the paper or a job search and they get applicants. It's just if you're at the right place at the right time, you've got the job. He said to me that his son-in-law, he was looking for a job and he heard that there was an opening in Yerucham. So he told his son-in-law to apply, and he applied at the right time and he got the job. And he said to me, of course, I didn't want to, you know, tell the Rosh Hashiva that my son-in-law was looking for a job. I didn't want him to be swayed in any chas v'shalom, you know, for protection. You know, but you know, you're not my son-in-law, so I'm happy to try to help you. And I thought to myself, you know, if I was son-in-law, he wouldn't help me. I'm a Talmud, so he's going to go to bed and try to help me get a job. And you know, it's on one hand so precious, but how many Rosh Hashivas, how many people are there like this? How many people, you know, really, you know, are so emistic? It's just, it was amazing. I mean, his Vekas and Emes was just so amazing. And then he told me, he said, and we all have vegetarian problems, not Yeshiva. Said, and he had to fight with the board, he said. He had to fight with the board. They wanted to let go of some of the workers at the bottom of the rung. And he said, how could it be? I'm getting a big salary. I'll cut my salary. That's the way they did it is that the people with the highest salaries got a big cut. They got a 20% cut. I'm making up the numbers. And the people with lower salaries got 15%. The people at the bottom, they got a 2% cut. And that's how he ensured that all the people in the yeshiva, the workers, the shuteyam, the Arab workers, weren't let go. It was a real, you know, lesson in emes, in yashrus, in sensitivity, and this affected the students. I remember when I was in yeshiva, I went back to Chutz Laaretz to visit my family, and before email, so the guy mailed me the ticket, the travel agent, and he made a mistake, and he agreed to fix the mistake. I was flying to New York, and from New York to Montreal, and he said to me, "Look, when New York mistake is fixed, Montreal, call them, they'll work it out." So sure enough, I called them, and they said, $100 to change the ticket. So I said, it was not my fault, it was travel agents. Listen, we can't help you, write a letter, and maybe you'll get reimbursed. So I was standing there at the, got to the airport, and they gave me the boarding pass, and they forgot to charge me $100. Although on the phone, they told me I would have to pay. And I was thinking to myself, listen, it was their mistake, it was the other guy's mistake. If I write the letter, maybe they'll give it back to me, I'm not sure, I don't know. Ken Zayn, and I thought to myself, if Rebbe was here, he would tell them. So I told him, look, I think I made a mistake. I really think I'm in the right, but you know, he told me I have to pay $100, and I'd like you to waive it. And I said, pay up. And I paid it. Again, it wasn't my money, it was the parents' money. But I thought to myself, Rebbe, you know, that Yashrus was something that was that he stood for. I think Yashrus also allowed him to really use his time appropriately, to really not waste any minute, because he felt like, why, Kadosh Baruch Hu gives me time in this world, I should use it to my utmost. I should, you know, if I'm employed, I should show up on time. I should use every minute I have to the best of my ability. Once he finished shiur, you know, like 5 minutes before the talk was finished, 5 minutes before lunch, so he said, start the next sugya. You're not going to get anywhere in 5 minutes, but you know, if you can win a basketball game in 15 seconds, so you can start the next sugya. I mean, he just fails, like, this is what we're here for. We're not going to, no hanachot, no shortcuts. He had amazing work ethic. I remember my brother was learning here in the Kollel, so he was thinking of traveling in the summer to India. And he consulted with Lukasin, and Lukasin discouraged him. He said, listen, you're going to go for a month to India, you can learn a whole sechta in a month. And yeah, he went anyway. And when he got back, he went into Rav Aaron in Katamon to say hello. So Rav Aaron said, you're in India, you're in the Himalayas, you climb Mount Everest. You know, for him, if you go to the Himalayas, so climb Mount Everest. It was a certain, you know, perfectionism, you know, about him. But the Jesus wasn't only in learning, it wasn't only looking up, finding the shittas in the Rav Yoh and the shittas in the Yitzur. It was also in interpersonal relations. I was at Chasna about 10 years ago. He was very 70 years old. And it was an American Chasna here in Eretz Yisrael. So in American Chasna, you know, the grandparents walked down. It's like a whole... So the old woman's walking down the aisle. And she was wearing heels. She tripped. So outside of Chasna, and she fell. And everybody's looking. And her Baron, under the chuppah, comes running down to help her up. I mean, there are people sitting right there. But both people, you see something, you just see, you know, Rav Aaron, he was a Zari. It was really special. I heard a hesped from Rav Yoel Ben Nun spoke about how during the Yom Kippur War, he was in the army, his wife had given birth, and to a boy, and the bris was in Alash Foot, there was a lot of snow. And, you know, he didn't think there was a chance he would get there on time to have the bris ito bezmano. And he came to Yerushalayim, when I got to Yerushalayim from the army, it was like 11 o'clock in the morning, and he went to the mall of Yerushalayim, Weissfurt, Zatzal, and he was very reluctant. You know, he had gone by foot the whole morning place to do brises, and he felt like, you know, going to lunch foot, in those days you have to go through Beit Lechem with a twisty road, take an hour with the snow, you're not going to get there. And he said, he had spoken to Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Lichtenstein said that he'd drive. He said, Rav Lichtenstein mukhan lisoa. So he said, Rav Lichtenstein osea, and he osea. And they went, and they talking about stock, and they got stuck outside Beit Lechem, and they had to get an Arab to help them, and they did the bris for Shkia. And Rav Lichtenstein smiled to have bris for Shmini, that zrizus for mitzvahs was amazing. By his 70th birthday, he quoted the pasuk, Zechor es borecha mibacharusecha, adesher lo yavo yimei hara'a v'yigiu shani mesher tomar ein li bahem chesed. And he said that, he was 70 years old at the time, he said, I'm 70 years old, but I think that I still, yimei bacharusecha, he said, I still feel that I have so much more to do, so much more to accomplish, and he's obviously responsible to have the energy, to have the ability. Said that the Ramban speaks about the avos as being svayamim in pasuk, and the Ramban says they felt they accomplished everything. How could a person feel like he accomplished anything? So, Taka, Tzaddik can feel that way, but people like us, we have more to accomplish. His Jesus was really unbelievable. I remember watching him run through the hallway with the Shas and Rambam back and forth to the shiur room, to the lunch room. It was just, he didn't walk. It was amazing. But I want to emphasize that despite the fact, like I said before, that he was so zariz, when it came to listening, to speaking to somebody, he would just sit there and listen, and listen, and he never cut people off. It was just really inspirational. He had many, many midos. I can't continue to describe them, just isn't enough time. But it was amazing that in each one of these midos, he was so mitzdayein, and the fact that as a conglomerate he was able to put them together, some of these mitzvahs were contradictory on some level. Just like you mentioned before, that educationally you want to be creative, but you can't be creative in certain realms. Meaning, he was able to integrate his mitzvahs in a very fascinating way, and he was consistent about it. He was consistent. You never saw him get upset. In a sikha, he would be upset, but interpersonally, you never saw him scream. It was just amazing how consistent it was. They say that, I think some rabbi said about Rav Kotler, that he was nifter, Rashi Nefis Parsha, Yadkin Aaron, Lahagit Shvacha Shal Aaron Shalashina. He, of course, meant that in regards to the fact that Rav Kotler was able to, you know, transplant Litvish, you know, learning and bring it to America. Rosenstein, you know, like the Rav, as Rav Rekevit likes to say, didn't transplant, but they translated. But I think you could say this Rashi, Lahagit Shvacha Shal Aaron Shal Hashina, in terms of his midos, he was consistent. He was consistently an Anna, consistently sensitive, consistently a Zariz. It was really inspirational. Some days I have a Zizu, some days I get to Seder at 10 to 9. And the other days I get to Seder at 9:10. But he was always there on time. It was just unbelievable. When Lichtenstein was master of Shlomo Zalman, he said about him something that Chatzal Abramsky said about Rav Zalman, who was Shlomo Zalman's Rebbe in Neitz Chaim. He said that even if Rav Zalman was the Goram Ares, even if he didn't know any Torah, he'd still be the most beautiful Jew in Yerushalayim. And Lichtenstein said that about Shlomo Zalman, and I think you could say that about Lichtenstein as well. The similarity between Lichtenstein and Shlomo Zalman, the kesher they had, and to Rabbi Soloveitchik, it was very special, and there's a lot to compare and contrast, mostly to compare. Maybe never felt that you know, you should cut a shear short just because the people are sitting. So, in a few more minutes, I hope you mochel. In terms of Hanhaga Tiburit, he wasn't just a Rosh Yeshiva, he was a communal leader, and he viewed himself that way, and he changed things in the community. Here in Israel, you know, he changed the Hesed movement, he raised the level of learning, introduced Bris Tzur Lomdus, he changed the attitude towards it. Somebody I heard from Rav Eima Kohen, Rosh Yeshiva Oniel, said that when he was growing up, so the Stark boys in the Yeshivat HaChaniyot would go to Kfar Hasidim, you know, they would let you in, you go to Panovich. There was a sense that Hezder was with the Evet, and Rosenstein didn't think that way. He wrote a whole article, Zotarat Hezder, where he argues that going to the army, given the Evet situation of having a wars and having the security situation, is the Chachila. And he changed the whole perception, self-perception of the religious Zionist community here at Israel. And he also changed the whole perception of what Torah means in the modern world. I mean, Rosh Shlomo Levi, who was Rosh Kol in the Gush, described how Rav Goldzich once came to give Sikha, Parshas Noach, and he said, yeshiva is like a teva, and outside there's storms, and if you want to leave the yeshiva, you need a heter from your Rebbe. And Lichtenstein, the next Shabbos, got up and said, Lech Lecha, we want to spread Torah, we want to, and again, there are many people who are Mukurov to Torah because of this philosophy of willing to, you know, expand the boundary of the Beit Medrash to look outdoors and try to influence and impact. And again, there are dangers, of course, you know, within the Kisha, and Lichtenstein was well aware of those dangers, but he felt this was a legitimate derech, and I think that the Zionist world in Eretz Yisrael has a lot has a great debt. Again, I don't know how much they appreciated him. I think he was perceived as being different, and he was. But he made a tremendous effect on the Sinitzi world, and he presented a different model of Zionism, a non-Mishichisti, you know, or cook model, which I think speaks to many people, and is something you know, that's easier to relate to, at least to many secular or Masorati people. Again, he could speak a lot about this, but he continued to serve as a manik to the modern Orthodox community in America even after he left, you know, both with through advising Rabbanin and articles and Orthodox Forum. They would schedule Orthodox Forum around his arrival. When he would come to America for the yeshiva dinner, that's when they had Orthodox Forum, because he would present the paper every year. And these are very significant papers that really shaped the direction of the modern Orthodox world. And I think he stood on the mishmar to make sure that, you know, the Torah Ma'ariv L'Chatchila was really Torah L'Chatchila, and it wasn't. There were some voices in the modern open modern world that I think he was able to speak out against. Again, B'dachi Noam. I mean, everybody was B'dachi Noam. When he would disagree with people, he would, like, you know, publish an open letter. You know, it eulogized Baruch Goldstein. He was livid. What did he do? He didn't make a machlokes. He published an open letter why he thinks it's inappropriate. And then people could have a chance to respond. To my dear, esteemed colleague. He didn't say, you're a moron. What a chil Hashem. You know, look what the New York Times says about this. He said, you have a legitimate opinion. I disagree significantly. I'm going to present the letter. And talk today, people weren't insulted. People were able to learn. And even when there are issues that were more clear-cut, he always felt he had to show the complexity. The letter he wrote about, renting apartments to Goyim in Eretz Yisrael. The issue is not all that complex, but to just give a psak that answer and to make it foursome is a foolish thing. So he shows the nuances in the psak, there are studies in the Hagel, and that it's not a wise thing, which again, people from America don't recognize it. Sometimes in the Eretz Yisrael, people don't realize that there's a whole world out there. It's like a different mentality. And he had an American, in that respect, American mentality. And his sensitivity to Chil Hashem was astounding. He couldn't deal with Chil Hashem. He went to Rishon Zalman to try to make shalom between Degel Torah and Eretz Yisrael. This is years ago. What's his connection to Degel Torah and Eretz Yisrael? That's a Chil Hashem. I have to try to solve the Chil Hashem. He had a tremendous sensitivity to Chil Hashem, and on a Siburi level, he would write articles, he'd publish them in the Aretz. He felt like he had to, when it comes to Hinatkut, Tukuda, he wanted a voice of reason to be heard, and he respected other people's opinions, but he very much wanted to try to influence the community, and he did. I think one thing that was very belated for me at the Levaya was the family. The children all spoke, and the fact that he was such a family person. When I was in yeshiva, his parents already had been nifter, but I read the Hespedim when I was in yeshiva that he wrote for his parents. And to really understand somebody, you have to know where they come from. And his mother wrote Chiddushei Torah. She's the son of the daughter of the Menahel and Tells. His father was a teacher. To see the serious nefesh they had for their children, his mother, they moved from Chicago to New York just so he should be able to go to Chaim Berlin, despite the fact that his father didn't have a job at the time in New York, tremendous serious nefesh. And his serious nefesh to his parents, again, I didn't see it myself, but you hear the stories, he would walk with his father who was blind and almost totally deaf, and he would scream, steps, one, two, saying, davening out loud so his father could daven. It's really it's worthwhile learning about his history because it really provides a certain insight to who he was as a person. Again, sense of a karza tov, having been spared the Holocaust, his family left France after the Nazis were already in control. That karza tov he had for being alive and for being able to learn Torah and teach Torah was outstanding. He writes about this in his Hakdama to Minchas Aron. The chinuch he gave his kids in terms of speaking to them in Hebrew, he's in the Sifri. I asked him about this when my daughter was born. I asked if I should speak to him in Hebrew. I knew he spoke to his kids in Hebrew, and my father, spoke to me in Hebrew. Adi was not so into it. She says to me, Elliot, you don't know how to speak Hebrew very well, you speak like your father. At least I know some Hebrew. He said, look, we'll make Aliyah, the kids know Hebrew. So I asked him to look at things. He says to me, he thinks that he's right. He has a neighbor who speaks to his kids in Yiddish. He doesn't speak Yiddish very well. He says, you can't scream at your kids in Yiddish, you shouldn't speak to your kids in Yiddish. Anyway, he spent time learning with his kids. He really was an amazing father. Amazing child, amazing father. Again, I'm sorry. I could speak more at length about these issues. I don't want to keep you. But try to finish up. He once said it was Tom and Yeshiva who wanted to learn with him. The Chavrusa. He said at the time. That time he was learning with each of his kids an hour a week, an hour three times a week. Six kids. So he said, I'll learn with the younger kids, Mishnayis, and you'll learn with me. He said, you can't learn with my kids. It's like asking me, it's like putting on tefillin for me. It's my chiyuv. Limatzim osam es v'neichem. And again, he viewed his talmidim like his children, but at the same time, his children were first. and he was able to educate his children with Torah and Le'ira because of the amount of effort he was mashkiach in them. In terms of Dikkuk and Mitzvahs, he had a couple of Brisker Chumras. He was Makan Yashin the Chutzlaret, he was Makbid on a very late Rabbeinu Tam, in terms of Shabbos, I think Achtel, I'm not sure exactly how late it was. I know that I was with him Motzei Yom Kippur, Motzei Tisha B'Av, Shechal Yos Motzei Shabbos, like this year, and after Kinos and Eicha, he was coming out of the shul, and he called his daughter. He called, I remember the details, he had his shoes with him, he didn't want to carry his shoes. It was like, an hour and a half after Zman, what we call Zman, he was still concerned about Rabbeinu Tam. He didn't rely on Erevin and citywide Erevin, but I think the Chumras were rooted in his Yashrus. How can you go against Shitas Rabbeinu Tam? Most Rishonim agree with Rabbeinu Tam. How can you go against the most Rishonim by Chodesh in Chutz La'aretz? I think it was a question of Yashrus, and I think that it's connected to the fact that he didn't sell chametz, and he didn't even rely on Mechiras chametz. Even after the fact, chametz was sold. Many people don't sell chametz gomer. He wouldn't rely on Mechiras chametz, even Achar Ma'itza, even if somebody else sold the chametz, because it's not a Mechira. I mean, he felt that Halakhi is a Mechira, but he felt like, in terms of Yashrus, you know, his aversion to Hezim Mechira, to Haromas in general, was very strong. I think, I never spoke to him about it, but I think it was because of the Yashrus. I know he was machbid to get an Esrog in the Torah. He was very careful about that. And again, you know, in the postgame you have simanim. The seeds are like this, the seeds are like that. But if you ask the botanist, they'll tell you that the simanim don't necessarily prove it's not murka. And he felt that, you know, he was machbid on that as well. But he also had kulas. I once asked him about shaving. He said to me, I grew up in the shadow of the Rav, the shadow of Moshe. You know, his anava didn't allow him to be machmir when kulas were nifsak al yidei other gedolim. We'll also talk about his relationship to tcheles. He personally didn't wear tcheles, but he was thinking of wearing tcheles as a result of Solomon. A lot of discussions about that. And there's more to say. I should say about his chumrah that he didn't like standing out. I once asked him about kashrus, and he said to me that he was out of chasna, and they told him there's some manot from Rav Reuben. And he said he didn't want to take the manot stam. He wanted to inquire what the standard of the regular kashrus was. And then, and only then, after he was inquiring, wasn't, you know, to the standard, did he take. He didn't want to stand out. He didn't want to be different. His daughter mentioned the idea of the Amal Am of Zichel Chorban. He's in Yerushalayim, in the community he lives in, people were makud. He didn't think that was appropriate to be makud, and that it's a sefer Shulchan Aruch. But he felt that, you know, oftentimes you should leave out a dish. You know, people don't do that. So he felt like he didn't want to stand out. He very much wanted to, you know, unless it was an issue of Yashrus. Most people say otherwise. He felt it couldn't be makel, but in terms of Bigadol, he very much tried to not stand out. That was, I think, connected to his Hanava. And despite the fact that he had many brisker chumras, he wasn't a brisker in nature, meaning he wasn't always, chared, he didn't have any mora shchora. He had shitas, and the shitas he was machim for, he wasn't looking over his chumra, over his shoulder, for other chumras. I once asked him, I had to go to a place that had not such a good hashkacha, it was Pesach time, I was very nervous. He said to me, Eliav, eit echa nema bisurim. He did, for him that was Yisod Mutzak. Okay, they're chumras, but like, he really didn't have that paranoia that some of the briskers, again, I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I don't think he didn't have it, and I don't think he thought it was a good thing either. Just to summarize, as Rosenzweig said, he was an Isha Ashkalot, a person who was so impressive in so many ways. One of the Sos of Mzayim, Mishmeis, Yosef Ben Yoel, Yosef Ben Yochanan, Bitu Ashkalot, Sos of Meiri, Ashkol, who Mashal, Isha, Nichlo, Bo, Shlemos, Amidos, Vishlemos, Achachmos, Kula. And I can really say, without hesitation, he was such a person. There are many other aspects of his personality that I can't discuss now. But I felt when I was learning with him, and I feel now, this tremendous chus. He's told me, "Come on, send the boy cut it up his side." How can Rabbi Yochanan buy the ksiv? He sees the coin through das the Torah vashu with you. He malach Hashem tzvakos. Who im dom harav malach Hashem yivakshu Torah with you. Im lav al yivakshu Torah mitiv. Malach Hashem, we were zoche. Those of us who were still meeting, and those of us who weren't, can be zoche to continue to learn from his legacy.